All right, as you can see, we're in 2 Samuel. So if you would be turning to 2 Samuel chapter 20. And as you get to 2 Samuel chapter 20, verse 1, and don't panic, I'm not getting ahead of you. Verse 1 is just going to say, now there happened to be a worthless man named Sheba. So it kind of just jumps right into a stage that's already been set. So I just want us to remember kind of how we got here. You know, I'm not going to take us way back, but back in chapter 15, you're going to have Absalom begin his rebellion. But even back before that, when the men of Israel went to David, it said the men of Israel and Judah loved David. It says that in 1 Samuel 18. They loved David. They go to David to make him king over them, and they said, David, we are your bone and flesh. And they loved him. But as David has a couple of bad instances, you know, he had to make some bad decisions. We're not going to rehash those today. But as we get to chapter 15, we see Absalom, who is ambitious, he begins to create a rebellion. You know, he gets these chariots to run before him, these 50 horsemen or these 50 horses and these men, and they kind of run before him, kind of as some big show that he's the prince. He's going to the gate early in the morning, and he's announcing, you know, it's a shame that there's nobody here to hear your case, because you have a great case. If I were king, I would see to it that you got a favorable ruling. You know, he kind of created some dissatisfaction with David. He created bitterness between the people and their king, his father. And he asked his father to, you know, to go and he to offer a sacrifice. And as he's gone to offer his sacrifice, he initiates his rebellion. David hears about this rebellion, and David flees Jerusalem. As David's leaving Jerusalem, as he's going down the Mount of Jerusalem and up on the other side, he runs across several men. Shimeah, who's cursing and throwing dirt at him the whole time, calling him a worthless man. You deserve to die. The blood of Saul is now being turned on your head. Just cursing all the way. He meets another man named Ziba, and he asks, you know, where's Mephibosheth? And at this time he assumes Mephibosheth has forsaken him. So he eases on. He gets over there. He crosses the Jordan. He had left a friend behind named Hushiah the Archite, who bought him some time. When Absalom was asking for advice, you know, give me some advice. He had two opposing views. One was, let's do a surgical strike, go kill David and David alone, and let's do it right now. That's what Ahithophel said. But that's not the advice he took. He took the advice of David's friend, who was acting similar to a spy there, who said, hey, let's go gather a massive army from the north to the south, as many people as the sand of the sea. You lead them, and we'll wipe out everybody who followed you, David. Everyone who followed David, everyone who has not bowed a knee to Absalom, we will kill. But both plans resulted in the death of David. They both involved killing David. So now all Israel, it says, wants David dead. Not all as Israel, but all as the majority wanted David dead. The ones who loved him now want him dead. And Ahithophel also had gave Absalom some advice of go into your father's concubines. He had left 10 concubines back to take care of the palace. And go into your father's concubine. That's what the advice that Ahithophel had left for Absalom. And he does that very thing. Soon after, he amasses this army and he marches out against David. And as he gets to fight David, his rebellion is squashed. David's men had done had the time and resources. They had the battlefield set, and they were just outmatched. Absalom was just flatly outmatched by David's men, their experience, and the terrain that they had set. And plus, God was on his side. That was a big one. But anyhow, so Absalom's rebellion is squashed, and Absalom is killed. So as Absalom is killed, you see in chapter 19, verse 10, you see where the stage is starting to get set here in chapter 19, verse 10. What they're really saying is, look, since the king, Absalom, is dead, we need to bring David back as king. That's what they're saying in chapter 19, verse 10. So David hears that all of Israel is wanting to bring him back into Jerusalem and make him king again, because he had fled Jerusalem. They're going to bring him back and make him king again. But the one tribe that hasn't mentioned bringing him back was Judah. His very flesh and blood. His clan, his family, his tribe. Now maybe they were the most uneasy about it because they had sided with Absalom. And maybe they was afraid that they was going to come back and just hang all the ones who had acted in treason. So David does two things right here. He demotes Joab, his general, who had been a wild card the whole time, or a loose cannon, as Todd put it last week, I think. He had been acting as a loose cannon throughout this whole thing. David demotes him and promotes Amasa, who had been Absalom's commander, just as a gesture of peace. Now, not only are we not going to kill the ones who rebelled against me, I'm actually going to take some of those men and set them up as commanders. Set them up as a commander of my own army over Joab. And there was nothing about Joab that promoted peace. I mean, we'll see that again today. So it was definitely a political move that not everyone who followed Absalom would be put to death. So David sends word to them, why have you not asked me to come back? You're my family. So they overcompensate, and they rush to bring David back. So it says that they're bringing David back across the Jordan. As they're doing that, the rest of the tribes get there, and they see Judas kind of done took their idea, quote-unquote, and beat them to it. You know, it was us who wanted to bring David across here. You didn't even mention it. And they go, well, he's our close relative. And that's just kind of where the bickering just kind of started. So they're bringing him across there, and as they're bringing him across, you see these men who had opposed David on the way out. Shimeah, who had cursed David on the way out, is basically begging for forgiveness. You know, he had cursed David, called him a worthless man. You know, you deserve to die. And I just love how in verse 19 of chapter 19, at the end of that, how the one Shimeah had cursed him. He said, oh, Lord, don't take it to heart. Don't let the king take this to heart. You're a worthless man. You deserve to die. Don't take that to heart, David. Just don't be so sensitive. I was just kidding with you. You know, but it seems like he's trying to. But anyway, David does spare him. David forgives him, and he's spared. So as we get down here, like I said, there's this huge fuss over we want to bring David. We want to have a part in this reception, in this ceremony of bringing David back in as king. The other 10 tribes wanted to do that, but Judah kind of ran and done it all on their own. So that's where this whole fight starts. You know, he is one of us. And they're saying, yeah, but there's 10 of us. You should have waited. But he's our close relative. And it said this whole fight began, this whole turmoil began to kind of swell. And that's where we get to verse 1. Verse 1 says, there happened to be a worthless man whose name was Sheba. There just happened to be a worthless man there named Sheba who's going to take advantage of the situation. The son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David. We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So all the men of Israel withdrew from David, followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, and the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from the Jordan to Jerusalem. So you see, David had just won the battle. But now he's in real trouble losing the kingdom. David had just put down one rebellion, Absalom's rebellion, and that rebellion ended with the death of his son. Now, just probably a week or so away from that, he's facing a whole other battle. He's in the midst of a whole other rebellion, Sheba's rebellion. And that's what we're going to read about in this whole chapter, is Sheba's rebellion. But Sheba was called a worthless man here in verse 1. The NIV actually calls him a troublemaker. And this description is used 15 times in the Old Testament. And every time it's described that way, it's talking about someone who is morally and spiritually corrupt. Way back in 1 Samuel 2, I'm not going to give you all 15, but back in 1 Samuel chapter 2, talking about the sons of Eli the priest and how vile and wicked they were called worthless men. 1 Samuel 2:12. in the incident with Abigail and Nabal, you know, Nabal's husband Abigail, all right? When Abigail was speaking of Nabal in 1 Samuel 25, it says, he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. So that's two examples that we have of worthless men, and they're both were morally and spiritually corrupt. And that's what the Bible describes this guy here named Sheba as being a worthless man. And he says, every man to his tent. That's how he ends this thing. Now, that's not necessarily speaking of their living environment, their living setup, because actually, in the last chapter, in 19, verse 8, 2 Samuel 19, verse 8, it has this exact same word. And it says, and all the people, I'm sorry, behold, oh my goodness. Anyway, it has the, now all Israel fled, every man to his own home. That's what it's talking about, where it talks about each man to his own tent. Every man went to their own home. So the kingdom right here we see is fracturing under Sheba. Sheba's just kind of promoting it. The kingdom is being fractured right here. And actually, if you were to fast forward, and I hate to do this, 50 years from now, when the kingdom is finally going to be divided after Solomon's death, during the reign of his son Rehoboam and Jeroboam, during that reign, the exact same battle cry goes out. 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 16. When all of Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, what portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. You see, that was the same battle cry they had. You know, Jeroboam, they all had this same battle cry that Sheba began 50 years earlier when we get to chapter 12. But they thought they didn't have any portion with David. All David was worried about was Judah. You know, he asked the clan of Judah to bring me back. They brought him back, and that's all. He was just their king. He cared nothing about being the king of all of Israel. That's the way they were reading this. And it says, all the men of Israel withdrew from David. They all withdrew from David, and they all followed Sheba. Now, these men were not really devoted to Sheba. They were just pretty much going along with the crowd, or they were just simply angry and upset. Because later in this chapter, actually down in verse 14, we're going to see where this man named Sheba, he was not really able to muster much of a large crowd. So we're pretty certain that this crowd wasn't necessarily devoted just to Sheba. But you see how they loved David earlier. Then they wanted David dead. Then they want David to be their king. We'll bring him back in. We'll let him be our king. And now they don't want him to be the king. Now they want to follow another one. You know, you see this. You actually see in Matthew, you know, you see as Jesus is marching into Jerusalem, they're screaming, Hosanna, Hosanna, Son of David, Son of David, King. They're announcing Jesus as king as he's coming in there. 5 days later, what are they saying? Crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And they are fickle people, like us. You know, how, whether it's politician, it depends on what side of the issue he's on, if you like him or not. He's either a real good guy or he needs to be out of office. Just like sports, you know, you love a running back until he fumbles on 3rd and 1. You know, or a kicker who lost the game because he shanked one. You know, just, it's funny how quick we can turn on somebody. But the good thing about it is, when we all stand before God, if and only if you're covered in the blood of His Son, He's consistent. He's constant. You know, you're deemed innocent. Your sins have been put away as far as the east is from the west, never to return no more. That doesn't change. When Paul has that in Romans 8 about, you know, what can separate us from the love of God, Jesus isn't fickle. God isn't fickle. But we are a fickle people. And they sure were. You know, we see that. So as we get to verse 3 really stands kind of in parentheses. You know, this whole chapter really seems to be focused on Sheba and his rebellion. But verse 3 is just kind of by itself. And David came to the house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house and put them in a house under guard and provided for them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. Now, the reason I went back a little bit is to make sure we understood these 10 concubines are the ones that he left behind to take care of the palace that Absalom went into at the advice of Ahithophel. These are those 10. So David puts them away, but he provides for them. But he just doesn't, he doesn't have any relation with them or any relationship with them, and they're just shut up until the day of their death, living as if in widowhood. Now, the one thing that most people pointed out about this was sometimes our sin affects others. You know, Amnon, when he sinned and he raped his sister Tamar, Tamar's the one that suffered. You know, she was actually lived as a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. Some people think she lived that way her whole life because of the sin of her brother, who lusted after her and tricked her into being locked in a room together with her. Our sin sometimes affects others. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. The sins of the father, you're not accountable for the sins of your father. You know, the sons are not accountable for the sins of the father, neither are the father accountable for the sins of their son. We always stand accountable to God for our own sins. But sometimes, when we sin, the environment that we create causes others to live in that wake. And I think that's what you have here. These are they're suffering for the sin of Absalom. The whole kingdom's really suffering for David's sin, and Absalom just kind of poured salt on that wound or kind of took it up a notch. But let's get on. Back in 4 and 5, we're back to the rebellion. Chapter 20, verse 4 and 5. Then the king said to Amasa, remember Amasa was his newly appointed general, over Joab, call the men of Judah together with me within 3 days and be here yourself. So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed him. That was the 3 days. That was his set time. So this is Amasa's task, and you're fixing to see his inability to perform that task, because he delayed past the 3 days that David had set for him. Now, he was the one who replaced Joab. He was Absalom's former general, and David had made him commander of his army as a conciliatory move, so to speak, at the death of Absalom. And he's told to go gather an army within 3 days. Go gather the men within 3 days. See, Absalom delayed. You know, the advice of Ahithophel was, let's go kill David tonight. But he didn't. He took Hushai the Archite's advice to gather a massive army, which took a lot of time, and it gave David time to regroup, to get his battlefield set, to get his generals in place. David's not going to make that mistake. You got 3 days. We're fixing to act fast. So David wasn't going to make the same mistake his son made. He was going to act fast on this. But Amasa was not like Joab. He didn't have the experience. He didn't have the reputation. He hadn't earned their trust. Talking about the people's trust. And really, if you think about it, just maybe a couple weeks earlier, he was actually taking part in the rebellion. And here this guy is trying to recruit me to come fight for him again. They maybe was a little unsure on which side of the fence he was on. He'd even led that rebellion. He wasn't just participating in it. He actually led the rebellion. But Amasa simply could not muster the men. And David could not lose the time. So David goes in verse 6 here. Verse 6 and 7. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba the son of Bichri would do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he get himself to a fortified city and escape from us." And there went out after him Joab's men and the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. They went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. So he goes and he says, look, he's taking too long. So he picks Abishai, and Abishai is Joab's brother. Joab's brother, whom he had a lot of confidence in. He's actually one of the ones that David set when David's dividing his army, when he's fixing to fight Absalom. He set a third under the under the command of Joab and a third under the command of Abishai. So Abishai was a proven general. He just wasn't David's commander-in-chief like Joab. So David tasked him to go do the very thing that he had told Amasa to do. But it's interesting that he says, look, this guy, Sheba, is going to cause us more harm than Absalom. But yet he was wanted them to protect Absalom during the whole battle. You know, protect the young man Absalom. Take it easy on the young man Absalom for my sake. But he knew that Absalom was doing great harm to the kingdom. But David, I guess just those fatherly instincts, didn't want anything to happen to his son. But I wonder if David had just maybe a hint or two that Amasa had defected to the other side. Because he hadn't returned back. You know, he hadn't come back in the 3 days. He delayed past that 3 day window that David gave him. Maybe he was beginning to think that Amasa wasn't capable of leading the army. Either way, David does seem determined to demote Joab because he doesn't call Joab up here and task Joab. He gives it to Abishai. Joab is still demoted. And if David would have called Joab, the promise he made in chapter 19 would be in question. In chapter 19, verse 13, David says this, "Say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also if you are not commander over my army from now on in place of Joab." So had David placed Joab back in charge, this promise could have been in question. But he doesn't. He places Abishai in charge. And he charges Joab's brother Abishai, whom he had quite a deal of confidence in. And he said, "Take your Lord's servants and pursue him." Now, there's really not a lot of conflicting commentary on this. Who is your Lord's servants? Some people say it could be Joab's servants because the very next sentence says he took Joab's men. You know, Joab's men. But David most likely is referring to himself. And he's referring to his servants. Take your Lord's servants. Talking about his men, his mighty men that he had. And you see that at the end of verse 7. And all the mighty men of David. That's who he most likely is referring to. Now the one group of soldiers are referred to as Joab's men because they had formerly been under Joab's command. That's why they're referred to as Joab's men right there. Let's jump on in verse 8 through 10 right here. When they were at the great stone that is at Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and set, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened on his thigh. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai's brother pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. So it's not that Amasa was trying to dodge his duty by not going to fight against Sheba. He just delayed. He just took more time than David really allowed him. But he meets up with him as Abishai, Joab's men, the mighty men, all this group of men is going to pursue Sheba, the Bichrite, you know, the one who had tried to start the second rebellion. Amasa catches up with him in Gibeon, which is about 6 miles north of Jerusalem. But as he gets there, it says Joab was wearing a soldier's garment and he had a belt with a sword in his sheath, fastened on his thigh, and it fell out. Joab was a seasoned warrior, and Joab was a seasoned assassin. It appears that Joab intentionally arranged for this sword to fall out. In my opinion, this was by design. What would happen, see, as Joab went forward, his sword fell out. So when Joab bent down to pick up his sword, Amasa didn't think anything of it. He's just picking, it's not like he went for his weapon. He was just picking up a sword that fell out of the sheath. That was Joab's plan. Amasa would not think anything about Joab picking up his sword. And then Joab gave these deceitful words. Is it well with you, my brother? Is it well with you, my brother? And he does everything in his power to give Amasa the impression that Joab was a friend, that Joab was an ally. Joab was family. They were cousins somehow. I tried to figure it out, but they were cousins. So he does everything to give him that impression. And then you see in verse 10, Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand. The New American Standard reads it like this: but Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand. Look, Amasa wasn't alarmed, and therefore Amasa wasn't prepared to defend himself. So with Amasa's guard down and the sword already in Joab's hand, Joab had to draw on him. And it was one strike. One strike and his entrails poured out. It didn't take a second time. David's not above killing someone in times of peace. This is actually, like I said, this is someone who was a relative of Joab, a commander. But notice that he grabbed Amasa by his right hand and kind of warmed him. Is it well with you, my brother? And he kissed him. I don't think it has anything to do with it, but it just, it's funny sometimes how your mind can race the kiss of Joab. How Joab betrayed Amasa with a kiss. Can we think of this somewhere else? You know, Judas betrayed the Son of Man with a kiss. So I'm not saying they're related at all, but it's sometimes it's good to just kind of think about those things. He warmed up to him, presented everything of this is fine. Just like he did Abner, how he kind of pulled Abner to the side in the midst of the gate as if to talk about something, and then just struck him in the stomach. Joab was an assassin, a murderer. Then we get on to verse 11 through 13. Verse 11. And one of Joab's young men took his stand by Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." And Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway, and anyone who came by seeing him stopped. And when the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into a field and threw a garment over him. When he was taken out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Joab is now back in charge. And if you're curious why Abishai isn't asserting his rule over Joab, I can only speculate, but here's some possibilities. Joab would kill his first cousin, Amasa. He killed the king's son, Absalom, against the king's command, I might add. Joab was part in one of the finest warriors, one of his finest warriors. Joab took part in the murder of Uriah. So Joab more than likely wouldn't hesitate to kill his brother. Joab was just a ruthless man. There's no way around it. So first, Amasa's delay. You know, Amasa's delay. At first, his delay was an obstacle to David's urgency. David wanted to act fast. Then Amasa's leadership was an obstacle to Joab. Now even his corpse is an obstacle, if you'll know that, to the troops. Because it said they're walking by and they see him, and when they see him, they just stop. Even his corpse is an obstacle. So they drag him out. They drag him out of the road, drag him to the field, throw a garment over him, and say, "Hey, whoever's for Joab, whoever's for King David, let's go." So they march on, chasing down this Sheba, the Bichrite, the one who had started this whole rebellion. I'll read 14 through 22. And Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth Maacah, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Maacah. They cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Listen, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you." And he came near her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he said, "I am." Then she said, "Listen to the words of your servant." And he answered, "I'm listening." Then she said, "They used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel. So they settled the matter. I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the heritage of your Lord? Joab answered, far be it from me, far be it, that I should swallow up or destroy. Ironic, isn't it? That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the son of Bichri, lifted up his hand against King David. Give him up alone, and I would withdraw from the city. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall. Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. And he blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. And Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. So this is pretty much self-explanatory. But it looks at the very beginning here, the Sheba's passing through all the tribes of Israel, trying to, you know, garner support for his rebellion. But he doesn't have, apparently, the charisma or the name recognition that Absalom does. Because it doesn't look like he's able to muster much of a crowd. Because it says, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. Now, if you notice, he is a what? He is a son of Bichri. Sheba, that's even back in verse 1. Sheba, the son of Bichri. And really, the only ones that followed him was his family, the Bichrites. No one else really seemed to get behind him. So they all followed him, and they all assembled, and they all went into this fortified city, which was the one thing David didn't want to happen. But they're in there. So Joab begins to tear down this city. You know, he's ready to tear down this whole place. So, anyway, as they get there, you know, a wise woman comes to the city wall and asks for Joab, and he goes and she says, look, would you destroy this whole city? And he goes, no, far be it from me to destroy. You know, that's not in my character. And after he just got through murdering countless people, Joab is just, he's just so tough to figure out. But anyway, he tells him what he's there for. He goes, oh, actually, we're here for Sheba, this man who's kind of opposed the king, trying to begin a rebellion. And he's hiding inside your city. This wise woman goes in her wisdom, relays the message to the men of the city. They catch that Sheba guy, and they cut off his head and throw it over the wall. And Joab leaves, just like he said he was. So the support that this Sheba had, they were so quickly to trade his head for peace. You know, he didn't have nowhere near the support for his rebellion that he probably thought he did. And he probably realized that when he got inside and heard him knocking on the door outside. But as we get to 23 and 26, it's just a list of some men here. In verse 23, Joab was in command of all the army of Israel, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Cherethites and the Peliathites, and Adoram was in charge of the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, and Sheva was secretary, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests, and Ira, the Jerite, was also David's priest. You know, just a lot of names right here that I really didn't do a whole lot of digging into, but the one that stands out to me was Joab. Joab went back to Jerusalem in the previous verse, to the king, and here it says he's back in command of all the army of Israel. So it seems like in the case of Joab, it seems like the ends justify the means. Or Joab's tactics are somehow okay because they work. It's what it seems. But like Burl, you had in your devotion, Galatians 6, we reap what we sow. That's God's word. Joab sowed violence and murder, and Joab himself will meet a violent death. He will be murdered or assassinated for his actions. We reap what we sow. Galatians 6 tells us that. Now, a couple of things. I enjoyed that song we sang, A Mighty Fortress. You know, the very last verse says, His kingdom is forever. You know, as we're reading about David's kingdom being torn and almost lost and barely won and then lost again, not with David's son, not with Jesus. His kingdom is forever. You know, we sing that song and it needs to resonate with us. But I also was reading this from, in conclusion, from Dale Ralph Davis. I'm going to try to paraphrase what he said here. But he's talking about Sheba. And Sheba wanted to leave David's kingdom. He didn't want anything to do with David's kingdom. And then he said there's men like Joab who have no problem with the theology. They have no problem admitting that David is their king. David is sovereign over them. But they just refuse to submit to David's reign. They refuse to submit to David's orders. And so he goes into this. He says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the ones who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. And he's saying there is such a thing as acknowledging the king's sovereignty, to acknowledging that Jesus Christ is Lord. There is such a thing as acknowledging that and disregarding his will and failing to obey. That's Joab. Joab knew David was king. He said that all along. He even, when he goes to this town, he says, look, they're raising up his hand against the king David. Joab knew who his king was. He just refused to follow orders. Time and time and time again. Such folks will have no place in the kingdom of heaven. And there are scores of Joabs on our church membership rolls, quote unquote, by Dale Ralph Davis. That's what he's speaking of here. He's taking this and he's tying it to how men can acknowledge God but fail to obey. That's Joab. And you have the men like Sheba, the Bichrite, who just want nothing to do with the king. They want to be their own king. And they search far and wide to gather support. But his kingdom is forever. The Lord's kingdom is forever. So I think this squashed Sheba's rebellion. Actually, I looked and he's not mentioned anymore after chapter 21. So when they cut off his head and threw his head over the wall, that kind of was the end of old Sheba. If you would, please stand. Jacob, would you please...